Chapter 12. Be done. I replied that I had entire confidence in his superior delicacy of feeling, and would abide by what he proposed. With this answer he seemed flattered, and sat down to write a note to the Baron. It ran thus. Sir, my friend, M.P., will hand you this note. I find it incumbent upon me to request, at your earliest convenience, an explanation of this evening's occurrences at your chambers. In the event of your declining this request, Mr. P. will be happy to arrange, with any friend whom you may appoint, the steps preliminary to a meeting. With sentiments of perfect respect, your most humble servant, Johann Hermann. To the Baron Ritzner von Jung, not knowing what better to do, I called upon Ritzner with this epistle. He bowed as I presented it, then, with a grave countenance, motioned me to a seat. Having perused the cartel, he wrote the following reply, which I carried to Hermann. Sir, through our common friend, Mr. P., I have received your note of this evening. Upon due reflection, I frankly admit the propriety of the explanation you suggest. This being admitted, I still find great difficulty, owing to the refinedly peculiar nature of our disagreement, and of the personal affront offered on my part, in so wording what I have to say by way of apology, as to meet all the minute exigencies, and all the variable shadows, of the case. I have great reliance, however, on that extreme delicacy of discrimination, in matters appertaining to the rules of etiquette, for which you have been so long, and so preeminently distinguished. With perfect certainty, therefore, of being comprehended, I beg leave, in lieu of offering any sentiments of my own, to refer you to the opinions of Sieur Hedelin, as set forth in the 9th paragraph of the chapter of Injurii per Applicationum, per Constructionum, A per C, in his Duali Lex Scripta, A non, Aliterc. The nicety of your discernment in all the matters here treated will be sufficient, I am assured, to convince you that the mere circumstance of me referring you to this admirable passage ought to satisfy your request, as a man of honor, for explanation. With sentiments of profound respect, your most obedient servant, von Jung. The Herr Johann Hermann commenced the perusal of this epistle with a scowl, which, however, was converted into a smile of the most ludicrous self-complacency as he came to the rigmarole about injurii per applicationum, per constructionum, A per C. Having finished reading, he begged me, with the blandest of all possible smiles, to be seated, while he made reference to the treatise in question. Turning to the passage specified, he read it with great care to himself, then closed the book, and desired me, in my character of confidential acquaintance, to express to the Baron von Jung his exalted sense of his chivalrous behavior, and, in that of second, to assure him that the explanation offered was of the fullest, the most honorable, and the most unequivocally satisfactory nature. Somewhat amazed at all this, I made my retreat to the Baron. He seemed to receive Hermann's amicable letter as a matter of course, and after a few words of general conversation, went to an inner room and brought out the everlasting treatise Duali Lex Scripta, A non, Aliterc. He handed me the volume, and asked me to look over some portion of it. I did so, but to little purpose, not being able to gather the least particle of meaning. He then took the book himself, and read me a chapter aloud. To my surprise, what he read proved to be a most horribly absurd account of a duel between two baboons. He now explained the mystery, showing that the volume, as it appeared prima facie, was written upon the plan of the nonsense verses of Du Bartas. That is to say, the language was ingeniously framed so as to present to the ear all the outward signs of intelligibility, and even of profundity, while in fact not a shadow of meaning existed. The key to the whole was found in leaving out every second and third word alternately, when there appeared a series of ludicrous quizzes upon a single combat as practiced in modern times. The Baron afterwards informed me that he had purposely thrown the treatise in Herman's way 2 or 3 weeks before the adventure, and that he was satisfied, from the general tenor of his conversation, that he had studied it with the deepest attention, and firmly believed it to be a work of unusual merit. Upon this hint he proceeded. Herman would have died 1,000 deaths, rather than acknowledge his inability to understand anything and everything in the universe that had ever been written about the duello. Littleton Berry. Tilde 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 end of text tilde 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 equals 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 diddling, considered as one of the exact sciences. Hey, diddle diddle the cat and the fiddle, since the world began there have been two Jeremies. The one wrote a Jeremiad about usury, and was called Jeremy Bentham. He has been much admired by Mr. John Neal, and was a great man in a small way. The other gave name to the most important of the exact sciences, and was a great man in a great way, I may say, indeed, in the very greatest of ways. Diddling, or the abstract idea conveyed by the verb to diddle, is sufficiently well understood. Yet the fact, the deed, the thing diddling, is somewhat difficult to define. We may get, however, at a tolerably distinct conception of the matter in hand, by defining not the thing, diddling, in itself but man, as an animal that diddles. Had Plato but hit upon this, he would have been spared the affront of the picked chicken. Very pertinently it was demanded of Plato, why a picked chicken, which was clearly biped without feathers, was not, according to his own definition, a man? But I am not to be bothered by any similar query. Man is an animal that diddles, and there is no animal that diddles but man. It will take an entire hen coop of picked chickens to get over that. What constitutes the essence, the nerve, the principle of diddling is, in fact, peculiar to the class of creatures that wear coats and pantaloons. A crow thieves, a fox cheats, a weasel outwits, a man diddles. To diddle is his destiny. Man was made to mourn, says the poet. But not so. He was made to diddle. This is his aim, his object, his end. And for this reason, when a man's diddled, we say he's done. Diddling, rightly considered, is a compound, of which the ingredients are minuteness, interest, perseverance, ingenuity, audacity, nonchalance, originality, impertinence, and grin. Minuteness. Your diddler is minute. His operations are upon a small scale. His business is retail, for cash, or approved paper at sight. Should he ever be tempted into magnificent speculation, he then, at once, loses his distinctive features, and becomes what we term minutiae. This latter word conveys the diddling idea in every respect except that of magnitude. A diddler may thus be regarded as a banker in petto a financial operation, as a diddle at Brobdignag. The one is to the other, as Homer to Lacus, as a mastodon to a mouse, as the tail of a comet to that of a pig. Interest. Your diddler is guided by self-interest. He scorns to diddle for the mere sake of the diddle. He has an object in view, his pocket and yours. He regards always the main chance. He looks to number 1. You are number 2, and must look to yourself. Perseverance. Your diddler perseveres. He is not readily discouraged. Should even the banks break, he cares nothing about it. He steadily pursues his end, and, ut canis a corio nunquam abstrebiter uncto. So he never lets go of his game. Ingenuity. Your diddler is ingenious. He has constructiveness large. He understands plot. He invents and circumvents. Were he not Alexander, he would be Diogenes. Were he not a diddler, he would be a maker of patent rat traps or an angler for trout. Audacity. Your diddler is audacious. He is a bold man. He carries the war into Africa. He conquers all by assault. He would not fear the daggers of free Heron. With a little more prudence, Dick Turpin would have made a good diddler. With a trifle less Blarney, Daniel O'Connell. With a pound or two more brains, Charles XII. Nonchalance. Your diddler is nonchalant. He is not at all nervous, He never had any nerves. He is never seduced into a flurry. He is never put out, unless put out of doors. He is cool, cool as a cucumber. He is calm as a smile from Lady Barry. He is easy, easy as an old glove, or the damsels of ancient bay. Originality. Your diddler is original conscientiously so. His thoughts are his own. He would scorn to employ those of another. A stale trick is his aversion. He would return a purse, I am sure, upon discovering that he had obtained it by an unoriginal diddle. Impertinence. Your diddler is impertinent. He swaggers. He sets his arms akimbo. He thrusts his hands in his trousers pockets. He sneers in your face. He treads on your corns. He eats your dinner. He drinks your wine. He borrows your money. He pulls your nose. He kicks your poodle. And he kisses your wife. Grin. Your true diddler winds up all with a grin. But this nobody sees but himself. He grins when his daily work is done, when his allotted labors are accomplished at night in his own closet, and altogether for his own private entertainment. He goes home. He locks his door. He divests himself of his clothes. He puts out his candle. He gets into bed. He places his head upon the pillow. All this done, and your diddler grins. This is no hypothesis. It is a matter of course. I reason a priori, and a diddle would be no diddle without a grin. The origin of the diddle is referable to the infancy of the human race. Perhaps the first diddler was Adam. At all events, we can trace the science back to a very remote period of antiquity. The moderns, however, have brought it to a perfection never dreamed of by our thick-headed progenitors. Without pausing to speak of the LD saws, therefore, I shall content myself with a compendious account of some of the more modern instances. A very good diddle is this. A housekeeper in want of a sofa, for instance, is seen to go in and out of several cabinet warehouses. At length she arrives at one offering an excellent variety. She is accosted and invited to enter by a polite and voluble individual at the door. She finds a sofa well adapted to her views, and upon inquiring the price, is surprised and delighted to hear a sum named at least 20% lower than her expectations. As he hastens to make the purchase, gets a bill and receipt, leaves her address, with a request that the article be sent home as speedily as possible, and retires amid a profusion of bows from the shopkeeper. The night arrives and no sofa. A servant is sent to make inquiry about the delay. The whole transaction is denied. No sofa has been sold, no money received except by the diddler, who played shopkeeper for the nonce. Our cabinet warehouses are left entirely unattended, and thus afford every facility for a trick of this kind. Visitors enter, look at furniture, and depart unheeded and unseen. Should anyone wish to purchase, or to inquire the price of an article, a bell is at hand, and this is considered amply sufficient. Again, quite a respectable diddle is this. A well-dressed individual enters a shop, makes a purchase to the value of a dollar, finds, much to his vexation, that he has left his pocketbook in another coat pocket, and so says to the shopkeeper, "My dear sir, never mind. Just oblige me, will you, by sending the bundle home? But stay. I really believe that I have nothing less than a $5 bill, even there. However, you can send $4 in change with the bundle, you know." "Very good, sir," replies the shopkeeper, who entertains, at once, a lofty opinion of the high-mindedness of his customer. I know fellows," he says to himself, "who would just have put the goods under their arm, and walked off with a promise to call, and pay the dollar as they came by in the afternoon." A boy is sent with the parcel and change. On the route, quite accidentally, he is met by the purchaser, who exclaims, "Ah! This is my bundle. I see I thought you had been home with it, long ago. Well, go on. My wife, Mrs. Trotter, will give you the $5 I left instructions with her to that effect. The change you might as well give to me. I shall want some silver for the post office. Very good. 1, 2, is this a good quarter? 3, 4, quite right. Say to Mrs. Trotter that you met me, and be sure now, and do not loiter on the way. The boy doesn't loiter at all, but he is a very long time in getting back from his errand, for no lady of the precise name of Mrs. Trotter is to be discovered. He consoles himself, however, that he has not been such a fool as to leave the goods without the money, and re-entering his shop with a self-satisfied air, feels sensibly hurt and indignant when his master asks him what has become of the change. A very simple diddle, indeed, is this. The captain of a ship, which is about to sail, is presented by an official-looking person with an unusually moderate bill of city charges. Glad to get off so easily, and confused by 100 duties pressing upon him all at once, he discharges the claim forthwith. In about 15 minutes, another and less reasonable bill is handed him by one who soon makes it evident that the first collector was a diddler, and the original collection a diddle. And here, too, is a somewhat similar thing. A steamboat is casting loose from the wharf. A traveler, portmanteau in hand, is discovered running toward the wharf, at full speed. Suddenly, he makes a dead halt, stoops, and picks up something from the ground in a very agitated manner. It is a pocketbook, and, as any gentleman lost a pocketbook, he cries. No one can say that he has exactly lost a pocketbook. But a great excitement ensues when the treasure trove is found to be of value. The boat, however, must not be detained. Time and tide wait for no man, says the captain. For God's sake, stay only a few minutes, says the finder of the book. The true claimant will presently appear. Can't wait, replies the man in authority. Cast off there, do you hear? What am I to do? Asks the finder, in great tribulation. I am about to leave the country for some years, and I cannot conscientiously retain this large amount in my possession. I beg your pardon, sir, here he addresses a gentleman on shore, but you have the air of an honest man. Will you confer upon me the favor of taking charge of this pocketbook? I know I can trust you, and of advertising it? The notes, you see, amount to a very considerable sum. The owner will, no doubt, insist upon rewarding you for your trouble. Me? No, you. It was you who found the book. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.